Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another in the series of Venice Film Festival episodes. We're about halfway through, well, from my perspective, halfway through, but my interlocutor this time, I think, is till the bitter end, probably, and that is Jonathan Romney.
Hello.
And you'll be writing, people can read what you'll, some of what you'll be talking about probably in Screen.
Yeah, Screen Daily and roundups in The Observer.
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay. And, well, how has the festival been so far for you? I guess it's pretty early, but...
It's early to tell. It's so far been patchy. The last few years, I think, have been really good. There's been, you know, a high level of, you know, those titles that you have to rush to see. Mm-hmm. And in the past, those titles have tended to be very good. This year, I don't know. The festival seems somehow anticlimactic at the front. I don't know. It may be completely flipped over. Sometimes it tails off towards the end. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of disappointments at the front. There have been a couple of very, very good films, mm-hmm. A few that are not bad, and a few very bad ones indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sometimes all over the map. But I think we'll start with a film that has a lot to talk about, but I'm very curious what you made of it, and that is Maestro, the second film that Bradley Cooper has directed. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Following A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born. Who can forget A Star Is Born? I have, in fact, forgotten a lot of it, I have to say, but anyway, enough editorializing. What did you make of Maestro?
Well, actually, it's really interesting because I really, to my surprise, really liked A Star Is Born, mm-hmm. Having no preconceptions whatsoever about Bradley Cooper. I don't quite understand Bradley Cooper. I don't really understand quite how he's become so prominent in the cultural imagination, although he doesn't really have, you know, he's clearly an imaginative person and quite a good director. And I have no image of him as a star at all. He seems to be kind of entirely without image or aura. And maybe that's why he works so well in a film like this, where he basically turns himself very thoroughly and very successfully into Leonard Bernstein. I mean, you can blink and you can see, gosh, that's Leonard Bernstein himself up on the screen with all the hair. And, of course, the nose, which proved very controversial. People were arguing about the nose for a couple of weeks before the film had been seen. There were accusations that this, you know, fairly reasonable-sized prosthetic nose was in some way an anti-Semitic stereotype. His family denied it. They said, no, Lenny had a nice big nose. And the Anti-Defamation League said, it wasn't at all anti-Semitic, you know. Oh. It's a film about a Jewish genius, so, you know, what's not to like? And being Jewish and also the owner of a nice big nose, I could dig it, you know. I have to say, just purely to get the prosthetic stuff out of the way, It did seem, the way it was filmed, and there are a lot of close-ups and the skin texture is very detailed, it was one of the most convincing makeup jobs I've seen in a movie like this. Yeah. And also the aging is for both he and Carey Mulligan, mm-hmm. who play his wife, Felicia, age extremely convincingly, and they both look absolutely like the originals. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I didn't even realize for his wife how much she did until I looked it up. To be honest, all of that talk about that kind of just, I did not think about it once in the movie. I don't know. And yeah, it's a movie that, I mean, kind of tries to find its way through his life without doing a thing of hitting milestones particularly. I mean, they definitely mark a few, but it's really more feeling its way through, I mean, I guess his sexual identity and his relationship, and also the relationship between the different types of work he does. And they kind of set up an echo between those a little bit, but not so much. And through the way it's filmed, it's also finds a way to connect all these worlds. There's some kind of bravura things it does early on of segueing through use of some combined use of like sets and I think CG wizardry from like an apartment to a stage. Although at one point I did wonder, did he have one of those apartments that did actually exist above Carnegie Hall or not? So that was kind of surprising because I wasn't really expecting that. I honestly didn't know what to expect about how he would approach it from visually. But yeah, what did you think?
I think bravura is the right word, and it's a very flamboyant film, but that works for a flamboyant subject. And, you know, the film shows that he was flamboyant as a composer, as a performer, conductor, and in his personal life. And at the beginning of the film, I felt that there was too much, you know, irrepressible sparkle and enthusiasm. You could see Bradley Cooper's eyes just gleaming through the makeup. But in fact, this turns on its head later on, because we realize how much of his existence was about disappointment and depression and about his inability to really take satisfaction in his achievement. It starts off with a quotation from him. He says that music doesn't give answers, it asks questions, but the responses to those questions are contradictory. Mm-hmm. And the film is about those contradictions, you know. Yeah. He was bisexual. How did he reconcile this very hedonistic life he had with all these young men around him with his real love for Felicia? Mm-hmm. It's also about the fact that, you know, he was able to be a very serious conductor of Mahler, etc., at the same time as producing these extraordinary hit musicals. So it's about, you know, rewriting the role of the maestro, in fact. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to a certain extent, Cooper also tries to rewrite the way a biopic might unfold. I mean, I found a lot of times there are a number of bravura sequences, but there are also sequences where he's pretty clearly sort of downplaying the dramatic tools he has. You know, there's like a really important argument in the movie that kind of has almost an understated punchline, but something that passes in the background, but otherwise is done in this pretty wide two shot between him and his wife. They have this kind of talk about his life, and that was almost too much for me. Like, it was like I just wanted something to cut in, but there are many times like that where he doesn't, which I thought was kind of interesting. There were points where I thought he was trying to make it seem a little difficult.
Yeah, I think he really avoids biopic cliches. For example, there's next to nothing in there about West Side Story,
right?
So it's very much not a greatest hits version of the biopic. It's also, you know, remarkably non-judgmental, particularly in our current climate of rushing to make judgment about people, because interestingly, Bernstein figured, he didn't appear, but he was mentioned as a background figure in Tar last year, which is all about, you know, the idea of someone being or being seen as predatory. You know, a composer who is predatory towards or manipulative towards younger proteges. And a lot of people would no doubt say now that Bernstein was predatory towards the young men who flocked to him. But here it's clearly not presented in that way. You know, he's presented as someone who was, you know, hedonistic in his musical career and in his love life. And there were a lot of young men who flocked to him. And there is a scene where he's meeting this young man and effectively seducing him. But it's played as this very warm, playful flirtation. But at the same time, you're aware of how his wife dealt with it all the way. So in a sense, Felicia and this response of hers to something that she has knowingly taken on, but that proves to be too demanding for her, is very much the core of the film. And Carey Mulligan, I think, gives a fantastic performance. In a sense, she is the performance in the film. And actually, I noticed in the end credits, she comes before Bradley Cooper. So I think that's testament to, you know, just how central her performance is. One of the things I loved about it is she and Cooper, and Cooper clearly directing and editing it, there's a real ear for a certain kind of rhythm of dialogue. You can imagine that this is precisely the way that, you know, the cultural bohemian world of America in the 40s, 50s, 60s, up to the 70s, that people would have spoken like this. And the way the overlapping dialogue works in party scenes, for example, it's fantastic. It's got, you know, more of a musical ear than you will hear in most films.
Yeah, no, he does a lot of crosstalk. That, yeah, also when he has family scenes, there's a fair amount of it there. And another portion of the movie is how, especially one of his daughters is dealing with her clear ambivalence about his relationships. And the movie, I mean, a lot of the movie is just about setting the social context for his life, and really less so about the music. Because I guess if there was something that really struck me is how for a movie about someone who's a conductor and a composer, there was comparatively little about composing, or I mean, there's more conducting because that's definitely more cinematic. but I somehow, I don't know if I expected it, but I would have somehow been more nourished by a little more. Not that I need him to give like a musicology lecture or something, but it seemed weirdly in the background. It really was more about his kind of emotional life.
Yeah, but also, I mean, you're certainly not shortchanged by it musically. There's a fantastic moment, which is the real kind of showcase moment in the film, which is a performance of a section from Mahler's Second Symphony in Ely Cathedral. And it's absolutely, it's the showstopper. And, you know, I think Mahler fans were hoping that, you know, following Tar, this would be another great Mahler film. and it is. It's terrific.
No, it's true. I mean, the performances are there, including a little bit of her performances, because she was a prominent, you know, TV actress and a Broadway actress as well. So they have a bit of that. And the movie's also kind of about how she puts that aside, and ultimately that can't be sustained.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea also that the way it shows that, you know, this kind of crazy intensity that Cooper has in the role, where you think, oh, he's overdoing it. But in a sense, he's not, because you become aware of just how much space he takes and how much he grabs the bandwidth in that relationship.
Yeah.
And really does, you know, like any extrovert, pushes the people around them to the sides.
Yeah.
But she gives an absolutely extraordinary performance. You know, just wonderful kind of modulations in her delivery, with a kind of touch of Katharine Hepburn, but sort of a little bit more husky. And I thought he was really overdoing it. There's a moment when he's on stage conducting, and he's you know, this sort of performance of ecstasy and the hair flying and his face in rapture. And then at the end, you see footage of the real Leonard Bernstein conducting, and he was exactly like that.
I love this habit. This is one of the more obvious of the "see, I did good, right?" kind of things at the end that they do in biopics, where they show you the actual footage. I mean, there is an element of emotiveness and also hamminess. There's kind of a bit of a plummy kind of hamminess to him.
Yeah, it is hammy, and I can't deny that the film is rather pleased with itself in a way, and that Cooper is sort of, as a director, he's waving his baton somewhat flamboyantly. But, you know, what can you say? It suits the subject very well. I found it, you know, quite riveting.
And Sarah Silverman is in it as his sister, which I didn't know about, so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It was good to see her.
Also, just a lot of general, like, I don't know, old New York lifestyle, shuttling to a country house in Connecticut or something like that, and walking around in Central Park instead of taking a bus or something. So, yeah, the only one-liner I have for the movie is that it puts the bi in biopic. So that is Maestro. I kind of wonder how this one will be received, for some of the reasons that we were talking about, just that it does hold back in certain ways. I thought, there's sort of a concerted attempt points to make it harder to lose yourself in it. Just a lot of long shots that I was surprised to see. But I think that's a choice. Another movie anticipated for different reasons, I guess, because it's directed by Roman Polanski. Many different reasons you might have for anticipating a new movie by Roman Polanski. And it's called The Palace. And it's entirely set in a Swiss hotel on New Year's Eve, 1999. And I don't know what to say about this movie. I couldn't believe it as it was unfolding, up to the very last image. Couldn't believe what I was watching.
Yeah, it promised well, because it's Polanski working with Jerzy Skolimowski and his partner, his wife, who've co-written it. And Skolimowski has had an extraordinary renaissance with his donkey film, Io. And this was really promising. I have to say, you know, whatever one thinks about Polanski, and a lot of people simply didn't want to talk about his last film, his film about Dreyfus,
which
didn't
get a new US release at all.
It barely got a release anywhere, and I think people complained about it being released in France. Problem is, it was a really very good film. You know, you can't deny it was a very good film, very, very old-fashioned, stately, yeah, but gripping, very well made. Mm-hmm. I suppose it really simplifies things for everyone, the fact that Polanski has now made an absolutely terrible, terrible... I mean, it's a stinker. It's one of the worst things I've seen.
Yep.
It's a farce set in a hotel, which is supposed to be a luxury hotel. It's New Year, 1999, 2000. The manager of the hotel, who's played by Oliver Masucci, who's a German actor who you may have seen in the time travel series Dark.
Okay.
He's the cop who gets stuck in time. He also played Fassbinder in a biopic a couple of years ago. So he starts off the film by saying, let's stop talking about this Y2K thing that everyone's worried about. We're going to have a fantastic time. We're going to show the guests the night of their lives. And all of these supposedly fabulously rich kind of, you know, Euro trash bon vivant,
yeah,
idiots and grotesques turn up at the hotel. Now, the problem is it's supposed to be a glamorous Swiss hotel. And, you know, these rich monsters turn up to dance the night away, and these Russian mobsters, mm-hmm, and their, you know, their supermodel girlfriends, and these dodgy financiers, and these kind of rich women with horrible, grotesque facelifts. And yet the hotel itself, I mean, it looks unbelievably tacky. You just look at the lobby and you think, these people wouldn't spend 5 minutes here. The lobby just looks plastic.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, we were talking about hotel movies just now, and Elizabeth Cabeza of Screen Daily said this is the Grand Ibis Hotel. You know, that's how tacky it is. It's meant to be, you know, it's meant to be Euro luxury, and it's like a kind of,
yeah,
you know, budget price motel.
Yeah, it looks really impressive from the outside. It looks like, I don't know, the Hotel Budapest, you know.
Well, that's it, but the Ibis version, yeah, you know. Yeah. And it's really, I don't know, it's shoddy. So John Cleese is in it. I mean, it's the cast, they're all grotesques and they're ridiculous. John Cleese is in it playing an aged millionaire, an aged American millionaire.
Like a Getty type. Marrying.
Yeah, with, yeah, a very young wife to whom he gives a live penguin as a wedding anniversary present. Mickey Rourke is in it looking really, I mean...
It's rough.
Yeah, his face has seen, as they say, his face has seen a few frosty mornings, playing a kind of weird financier, vulgarian, with some kind of scam...
Yeah.
To make a fortune, but you don't really understand what's going on. He's made a deal with some kind of banker who's this sort of nebbish figure who's out of his debt, but you don't really understand what they're up to. We know that someone has flushed some documents down the toilet, but it doesn't really connect with anything.
Right.
There is an aging, retired male porn star who is supposed to be based on Rocco Siffredi, and people keep complimenting on him on the size of his dick, but he says, oh, I don't do that stuff anymore. And he's got a broken nose, and this is connected with nothing. But actually, the really creepy thing, so there are a bunch of elderly women with kind of, you know, really, really worked over, basically, you know, cosmetic surgery casualties, and they're all sort of falling over their plastic surgeon played by Joaquim de Almeida. And one of them I noticed in the credits is Sidney Rome, who appeared once upon a time in the early 70s in Polanski's film, Who? Is that the title? Who?
I thought it was What.
Or What?
Yeah.
What? Okay. Who, What, When? And she was astonishingly beautiful then, and she had plastic surgery, and really? It was, she is one of the most, you know, remarkable cases of, I think, you know, an early case of, you know, why it's not a good idea. And she appears in this film, and there are all these gags about these women whose faces have been ravaged by this procedure, and she's in it. And either she's kind of joined up with Polanski as part of a, you know, a kind of satirical protest, mm-hmm. or he's using her and all those other women very cruelly, but it seemed very unpleasant. And the way he uses Mickey Rourke as well, there are a lot of close-ups of him, and it's got no kind of heart, this film. It's not funny, it's ugly, it's cruel, it's kind of sluggish, it's mm-hmm. obvious. But the other thing about it is that, you know, farce is meant to work. Fast, it's meant to be snappy, it's meant to work fast, but also everything's got to connect up. You know, a good farce, you know, the Fedo variety, should be like a precision machine where every piece clicks into place, and by the end, the whole thing collapses in a house of cards.
Yeah.
And there's none of that here. It's absolutely slapdash. It's,
yeah,
it's tacky.
I couldn't figure it out. I you know, when I thought about it later, I thought, like, is any of that supposed to be intentional? Is he trying to make a bummer movie, you know, because he did, but it doesn't feel like it's intentional. Is he trying to make it anticlimactic because it's about, you know, this moment in time? I mean, I just began to find it baffling. I was so baffled, I wasn't even as annoyed by it. There's another plot point of a family that materializes who claims to be, the father claims to be the son of Mickey Rourke's character.
Which goes nowhere.
Goes absolutely nowhere. And in the abstract, I can kind of think about that and say, oh, that could be kind of an interesting gesture to have like this floating displaced family in there. But nothing clicks. Nothing looks good. It's just from a filmmaking perspective.
Yeah. And the music is horrible. Alexandre Desplat music was awful. The other thing about it is that there's a kind of, well, there's a joke about a woman with Alzheimer's, which is not funny.
No.
Theoretically, you could make that joke funny if you played it out in a certain way. But, you know, that's just theoretically. I'm yet to see it, but here it's not funny. And there's another gag about a character dying. We won't say which one, but the corpse has to be disguised so people think. And I came out of that film thinking, it's Eternity at Bernie's.
That's right. Yeah, I think we can leave it at that. We don't need to wheel around this corpse anymore. Yeah, that's The Palace. The last, I don't know, Roman Polanski film. I was going to say we should talk about El Conde, but I don't know if we were either fans of that particularly.
I have to say one thing about El Conde is it did have a fantastic Margaret Thatcher impersonation.
Yes.
I mean, it's a little better than impersonation, a very good performance, but beautifully done by the British actress Stella Gonet, who, you know, made the film. Just hearing her voice made the film.
Yeah.
But it's a very clumsy satire on the idea of Pinochet as a 250-year-old vampire, but the film is sort of bloated to such an extreme. It's a one-joke film, and it has nothing to say. And it's a shame because Pablo Larraín made some great films with a kind of sideways view on the Pinochet years of Chile.
Sideways is a good word to use because he does have, I mean, he must write and film to a certain extent based around this, but it always feels like he finds some editorial scheme for a film that's sort of interesting. It circles in some interesting way. Like, I unwittingly find myself to be kind of a Larraín defender of movies from Spencer to Neruda. And in this case, I just could not find my way through this movie. And I don't know if that was, again, like a willful attempt to not make it too easy. Yeah, because the metaphor is right there flying at you. But yeah, and I mean, briefly, just the story is, that Pinochet has kind of holed himself up, and he's actually a vampire. He has holed himself up in this house in the hinterlands, and his children have come to try to sort out his financial legacy and run away with some cash. But there's I guess this is a good part of the movie. And this actress is great. I kind of wish I knew her name. A kind of private investigator nun.
She's a nun accountant exorcist, which is what I call a hyphenate.
Yeah, that's right. Who is trying to kind of pick apart what's going on. And it's pretty, I thought, like, mesmerizing performance. But it's constantly flying apart. I didn't really know what to make of it. So that's El Conde, which is going to go on Netflix, like, I think within a couple of weeks. So you'll all be able to see it for yourselves.
I will say it's very strange about Netflix movies, you know, Netflix prestige auteur movies, because particularly this one, it's had so much money pumped into it. It's so lavish. It's so spectacular. And of course, the same thing will happen. This happens with all Netflix movies. You know, people will watch for about 3 days and be talked about on social media, and it'll be completely forgotten. And that's the rhythm, you know, even when a film is really, really good. You know, there are only a few exceptions to that. But, you know, if you remember the Charlie Kaufman film a couple of years ago.
Thinking of Ending Things.
And people talked about that for a couple of days, and then, you know, things disappear into the endless ocean of Netflix product. And it's not a good showcase for filmmakers.
It also is weird that there's this kind of, there's a through line through a lot of these big auteur movies, is that they're kind of bloated, the one Netflix supported one. Not as a general rule, and I actually wouldn't say that about the Kaufman one, which I found like really gnarly in an interesting way. But like Bardo is an easy example of that. Just a film where it's like, it's almost like this devil's bargain that goes on. Be careful what you wish for. You know, be careful if you get everything.
Exactly. And Bardo did get trimmed, in fact.
Yeah, that is true.
I didn't see the shorter version, but the long one was... anyway, that was a year ago. That was a horror we don't have to think about anymore.
Well, let's end on a sweet note, and that's the Wes Anderson short to medium length film. It's like 40-something minutes, I think. The Tale of Henry Sugar, which is adapted from the Roald Dahl, which is actually... I remember it being as part of a collection, The Tale of Henry Sugar and Six More, I think is what the title was. So it'd be several stories, actually.
And apparently there are more stories that he's already filmed. So it's going to be a kind of project that expands.
That's great, yeah. And I found this a wonderful confection with, you know, the curious mixture that he has now of what he was doing before, but also this increasing, like, interesting fussiness about the framing of the, like, meta framing of the story. I don't know, what did you make of how it was put together?
Well, I wasn't mad about it, but it did remind me of the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is maybe my favorite, second favorite film of his after the Royal Tenenbaums, which is a much simpler affair. It's before he sort of goes full Wes. But I really like the Grand Budapest Hotel, which begins similarly with a writer writing a story. And in this case, it's Roald Dahl himself, played by Ralph Fiennes, who is actually quite uncanny. He doesn't necessarily look like him, but he has something of Roald Dahl's narrating voice, his actual speaking voice, and his narrating style. And he narrates, he starts telling the story, he looks at camera with that sort of slightly sour, grumpy demeanor that Dahl actually had, and starts telling the story. And the film, it's only 40 minutes long. It comes with a great deal of visual trickery and very, very simple trompe-l'oeil stuff that's much more Brechtian than Anderson usually is. I mean, it's literally scene shifting. So the whole thing could be going on a stage in front of you, although, of course, it's more complex than that. But there are wonderful tricks, like people are sitting levitating cross-legged, and you actually realize that they're sitting on boxes which have been painted so that you don't see them, and then they move the boxes. There's some really nice performance in it from Ralph Fiennes, from Benedict Cumberbatch
as Henry Sugar.
And Dev Patel is in it, and Richard Ayoade are in the stories. And it's, you know, it's small. It actually feels, for a Wes Anderson film, and given how sort of tricksy and toy boxy it is, nevertheless, it feels quite sort of relaxed and informal.
Yeah.
And it's very likable.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's presented almost like it's a, you know, like a run-through or something, like a dress rehearsal run-through, for a number of reasons, partly because of the way they're like wheeling sets on and off. It's almost like a, you know, a full-length version of one of those let me show you my boat kind of sequences, like, you know, or, you know, there are sequences of French Dispatch that came to mind or something. And people are talking in this very particular cadence, sort of theatrical, almost patter-like at times, and it's wonderful to listen to. It's some combination of like speech and storytelling at the same time. So I love that.
And it's shot again by Robert Yeomans, but it just looks a bit. The textures are a bit rougher this time, mm-hmm. and it feels just looser. You know, there's some air in it. And actually, the last two films he made, I didn't like The French Dispatch at all, and I really, really didn't like Asteroid City, okay. which felt completely airless, and there was only one human being in it. I felt that it was Scarlett Johansson.
She's great.
Saved the film with her performance. But this is, you know, human beings being human beings again, and clearly having a great deal of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And Benedict Cumberbatch doing a very funny kind of quick change disguise act at one point is very nice.
Yeah, I guess a first time Wes Anderson player, but it seems like he could be a repeat addition in later
to the Manor Born.
Yes, to the Manor yeah. Born.
Although one film we didn't talk about very briefly, I think it's worth mentioning, was Bastarden, a.k.a. The Promised Land, which was a really nice surprise, which is a sort of 18th century Danish Western by Nikolaj Arcel, which is about, apparently it's a true story of a soldier who went to Jutland in the far north to colonize a sort of barren heath, which was supposed to be uncultivatable. And he gets on the wrong side of the local squire, who proves to be a very viciously nasty character indeed, in a very tyrant. Grandiose, almost a kind of, you know, junior Bond villain. But he's like one of those evil cattle barons in the Western. And if you think of it as a That's northern, true. I'm not sure what the Swedish, the Danish version, the Swedish version would be a smorgasbord Western.
Right.
I'm not sure what the Danish equivalent is. But it's very good indeed. And it has Mads Mikkelsen at the center as the hero, with this absolute, you know, fixed mouth. You know, his mouth never barely parts his lips.
Yeah.
And I think there's like just the kind of faintest, chilliest shadow of a half smile towards the end. But he has become, you know, the new great stone face of cinema. And he's brilliant in this. He's wonderfully impassive as he goes through this kind of hell on earth, battling, you know, wind, rain, and at one point torture by boiling water. But it's very, very good. It starts off, you think, oh, this is going to be a bit kind of stuffy, it's costume piece, but it's really as storytelling, it's the most enjoyable thing here.
And people will be able to see that one, at least in the US it has a distributor. So that's The Promised Land, and I think we can probably wrap it up there. Our cue is that the ice is starting to be broken, is chipped away at for the evening drinks. So I guess that's...
Which I don't think we're going to be enjoying just yet.
Just yet. We're off to more movies. We'll leave it there. And pleasure as always.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.